day. It's just another day on earth. Oh, it's just another day. Just another day. It's just another day on earth. Oh, it's just another day on earth. It's just another day.
Welcome to The Digital Divide on KBOO Portland. All right. Today, I'm so excited. Actually, let's go back in time. In February, we had the opportunity to talk with experimental electronic music artist Christy Denton. Christy is a Portland-based composer and sound installation artist who works with found sounds, electronics, and homemade and modified instruments. And today, we're going to be talking about women in electronic music from a more historical perspective. We're going to dive into the biographies of three amazing women whose names you've probably never heard of, but whose contributions influence all music made with electronics, synths, and MIDIs today. Women whose contributions affected nearly all modern music. Today they get their due on The Digital Divide. So let's start with, I'm your host, Rabia Yeaman, by the way, of The Digital Divide. The history of electronic music, the Oxford Dictionary defines electronic music as music performed using synthesizers and other electronic instruments. And that definition might spawn a debate into, you know, what is the difference between music, sound, and noise, but that's subjective. That's a very individual matter. And that is completely dependent on your point of view or your opinion. Trying to define electronic music in itself is a challenge. Yes, there must be electricity, and that is where all commonality ends. Electronic music may not include any traditional instruments, or it might. What it is capturing or creating noise or sound, possibly recording it, maybe altering it, combining, clipping, overmodulating, layering it, looping, or an infinite number of other things that you can do to sound. And many of us tend to think of electronic music as music with beats or performed with synthesizers, and it is, or it can be, But that is not the end of the story, and it's certainly not the beginning. You've probably heard electronic music with a theremin. You've probably heard the theremin. It's an electronic instrument played without actually touching it, but by hand movements above the instrument. And maybe you've already heard electronic sounds and theremin music in your favorite sci-fi B-movies of the 50s and 60s, maybe in the language of your favorite robot, or a movie soundtrack like Mars Attacks. And what I want to do today, listener, is I want to challenge you. I know that this might not necessarily be the type of music you'd pop in on your car radio, or even in a CD necessarily, but I want to challenge you today to stick with the show, to hang in there. I haven't put together any clips that I think are going to in any way damage your ears or your psyche, but you might find it different. And it might be a challenge, challenging listening, I guess is what I want to say, challenging listening. And I want to put that challenge out to you because the women that we're going to talk about and learn about today are so revolutionary and so fascinating in their art and how they approached it. And you're going to learn about that if you stay tuned in. So let's talk about the first electronic instrument. And that was... believed to be in 1759, the Jesuit priest Jean-Baptiste, and I will forgive me for mispronouncing every foreign name or non-English name, in Paris, France, invented the clavecin electronic or the electronic harpsichord, one of the earliest documented instruments that used electricity to create musical sound. And despite its name, the clavecin electronic was not a stringed instrument, but a carillon, which is bells, a keyboard instrument using a static electrical charge to vibrate metal bells. This method allowed the player to create a series of sustained notes from the bells, similar to an organ. And since no sound had been captured and recorded, we might imagine it sounded something like this. Well, we think it might have sounded something like that. The first woman that we're going to talk about is Clara Rockmore. Clara Rockmore was a classical violin prodigy and a virtuoso performer of the theremin, the hands-free instrument that I had mentioned earlier. The theremin is an electronic, a musical instrument controlled without physical contact. It is named after the westernized name of the Soviet inventor Leon Theremin, who patented the device in 1928. Clara Rockmore made orchestral appearances in New York and Philadelphia and went on coast-to-coast tours with Paul Robeson. And in 1977, she released a commercial album called The Art of the Theremin, produced by Bob Moog. It featured Rockmore's theremin playing with piano accompaniment by her sister Nadia, a concert pianist. Let's listen to a short sample. Theremin by Clara Rockmore. Mm-hmm. Claire Rockmore on the theremin. Rockmore's approach to theremin playing emphasized physical and emotional control. Remember, this is an instrument that you play by making hand gestures and movements above the instrument and not by touching it. As she described it herself in an interview, you must not only hit a note, but you must hit the center of it. You cannot register any of your internal emotion at all. You cannot shake your head, for instance, or sway back and forth on your feet. That would change the tone. Rockmore saw limitations of the original instrument and helped to develop the theremin to fulfill her needs, and she worked very closely with Leon Theremin to modify and increase the sensitivity of the theremin's volume control to facilitate a more rapid staccato, lowering the profile of the instrument so the performer is more visible, and increasing the sensitivity of the pitch. Next, we'll dig into the 1960s optical synthesizer or Ramix machine. You just have to love the name of that. If you don't have any idea what it is, the optical synthesizer or Ramix machine, or even just or Ramix machine, don't you want to know what it does? Perhaps the best synthesizer name ever, and named after its inventor, Daphne Oram. Daphne Oram, born 1925, was a British composer and electronic musician. Oram was one of the first British composers to produce electronic sound and was a pioneer of the music concrete, a kind of cut-up sound that started in the 30s. Of course, keep in mind, there was no hard drive to store any of this on. Even though music could be produced with electricity, it was always captured at this time on tape, magnetic tape, you know, reel to reels. And so the music concrete was what we could call cut up sound, taking sounds and cutting and splicing them together to create a composition, a musical or sound composition. She was the creator of the Oramix technique for creating electronic sounds, and a co-founder of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, and a central figure in the evolution of electronic music. Besides being a musical innovator, Daphne Oram is credited with being the first woman to direct an electronic music studio, the first woman to set up a personal electronic music studio, and the first woman to design and construct an electronic musical instrument. The BBC Radiophonic Workshop was one of the sound effects units of the BBC. It was created in 1958 to produce incidental sounds and new music for radio and later television. The unit is known for its experimental and pioneering work in electronic music and music technology, as well as popular scores for television, including Doctor Who, during the 1950s and 60s. Let's learn more about Daphne Oram and her amazing Oramix machine.
Here in a country studio in Kent is Daphne Oram, a pioneer of a new type of music. Unlike the traditional composer, she uses no musical instruments and no musicians. She produces sounds by electronic devices, some of them sounds unlike any ever heard before. She needs no concert hall or opera house to put on a performance. She can do it on a tape recorder. The sounds, produced electronically, are recorded on tape. By mixing the sounds on various tapes together and playing them at varying speeds, she can produce all sorts of different combinations. Already, electronic music is being used in films, television, and the theater, and there have been concert performances too. There are some people who think the music of the future will sound like this.
Imagine unearthing a piece of tech history that you thought had been lost forever. Well, nearly half a century after it was invented, the Oramix machine is once again center stage thanks to the London Science Museum.
Half a dozen times in a curator's career, across something which is so wonderful, it has to be added to the collection. The Oramix machine is one of those machines. People talk a lot about the idea of things being unique, but this really is. This is the only Oramix machine. It's the Oramix machine made by Daphne Oram in the 1960s, and it is the equivalent in the collection of some of those really great engineering and scientific breakthroughs. It is as important for electronic music as the models of the Great Eastern Ship are to the history of maritime engineering, for example. It's a crucial piece.
And for those who don't know what Oramix is LJ Rich.
Over the past decade, music production has changed beyond recognition. Forget high-end hardware in a dedicated studio. Now we're all potential bedroom musicians, able to compose masterpieces on a home computer. For example, if I want the sound of an orchestra's string section, I'd select it.
These are virtual instruments, or soft synths. Now, the way they work is generally in two different ways. One is called a sampler, and that will play back audio snapshots of real instruments when you play a note. The other one is a tone generator, and the way that works is by making a sound inside your computer for you. Now, it's the second one that's most closely related to the Oramix machine.
And this three-part machine is the extraordinary instrument in question, rehabilitated as part of a year-long exhibition about the history of electronic music. It now stands as a musical relic, too delicate to play any longer. But at its time in the early 60s, this elementary synthesizer helped to spearhead a new chapter in electronic music development. As its name suggests, the Oramix machine embodies the spirit of Daphne Oram, a visionary musician who took her inspiration from her European contemporaries. Enlisting the help of two engineers, together they assembled a one-off masterpiece of musical engineering.
Daphne Oram was undoubtedly an extraordinary person with an amazing mind. And she was able to imagine electronic sounds that she couldn't actually make. So, having set up the BBC Radiophonic Workshop in 1958, she left pretty sharpish because she wanted to pursue her own ideas about how you could make electronic music, which in her mind was all about how you could change drawings into sounds. And that was her experimental program.
These sounds would be generated by drawing on a glass slide. A light dot would trace the waveform, and the sound generator would provide a tone based on the shape the dot followed. Further drawing on 35mm film strips was needed if you wanted to change the character of a note, like the pitch or echo.
I thought if one could break down the whole process into separate parameters, then define each of these in a drawing, which one could go back and rub out, the one didn't want, what one had done. This would both simplify the thing, it would make it much quicker, and I think open up completely new sounds.
It's thought the machine was monophonic, that is, it could only play one note at once. Although the curators are not entirely sure. There was space for it to play up to four notes together. The reason it's so difficult to tell is that the machine was always being tweaked and modified throughout its life. As the Oramix machine is too fragile to restore to playable order, there's an interactive visual display that lets visitors play with a virtual machine. There's even an Auramix iPhone app for those who wish to take matters into their own hands. And the Science Museum's also running a remix competition on its website for those who want to submit their own compositions.
The big historical story with electronic music is that it's got cheaper and cheaper and easier to do. In many ways, it's become too easy to make electronic music. And I think some of the most interesting areas in electronic music are where people are trying to reintroduce some constraint, trying to reintroduce some difficulty, where they're sampling sounds and changing sounds and building new sounds from the ground up.
Daphne Oram died in 2003, an unsung hero. But even if her machine is no longer playable, her ideas have left an indelible mark on the electronic music of today.
You. It's Mission Moon for Studs Lego. He's off to pioneer the empty spaces of the moon with Lego, his wonderful building bricks.
Build bridge.
Lego builds it.
Build moon tractor.
Lego builds it.
Build missile defense center.
Lego builds it.
Lego, the wonderful building toy, builds a whole wide world for you.
And that was the Auramix machine, the optical synthesizer Auramix machine invented by Daphne Oram. And the original radiophonic workshop based in London closed in 1998. To the Digital Divide on KBOO Portland. This is your host, Rabia Yeaman. We're listening to a track by Delia Derbyshire, our next and final woman in electronic music for today. We'll be right back. Derbyshire on the Digital Divide. Born 1937, an English musician and composer of electronic music. She's best known for her pioneering work with the BBC Radiophonic Workshop during the 1960s, particularly her popular electronic arrangement of the theme music to the British science fiction television series Doctor Who. Let's learn more about Delia Derbyshire.
The Delian mode, the track we've just heard, was created at the BBC Radiophonic Workshop in the 1960s by Delia Derbyshire, the woman responsible for sending children scuttling behind the sofa with a distinctive and chilling Doctor Who theme tune. Relatively unknown, but remarkably talented, she's slowly being recognised as one of the pioneers of electronic music.
Well, the first stage in the realisation of a piece of music is to construct the individual sounds that we're going to use. To do this, we can, if we like, go to these sound generators here, electronic generators, and using all of these, we can build up any sound we can possibly imagine, almost.
Golly, have I not told you this? This is interesting. I'd heard about the Radiophonic Workshop, and I said, oh, I want to... But I was so keen. I went there on my days off, just observing. So that's where I learned about tape manipulation.
In the early 1950s, tape recording was invented or came into being. What it led to was the ability to manipulate sound.
To some people, the possibilities of doctoring natural sound using the new magnetic tape became an obsession. In 1958, a reluctant BBC was forced to allow a tiny group of enthusiasts to get some gear out of redundant stores and establish itself here in two rooms in London's Maida Vale.
Maida Vale was an old skating rink. The BBC had bought it just before the Second World War and had built studios on top of the skating rink. The whole building looked like a mildewed wedding cake. It was covered in sort of cream plaster stucco, which was peeling off in many places.
You're walking down the corridor and you stop at the door that's got room 13 written on it.
It was called the Radiophonic Workshop, and they started doing radio plays originally, and then television got interested, and then it sort of started to balloon. After 5 years, of course, television started to take over. I would say the breakthrough with television came with Doctor Who, written by Ron Grainer, realised by Delia at the workshop.
Must have been astounding, and now is easily recognised as one of the most famous, maybe best, theme tunes. I mean, it certainly does its job incredibly well, and it made what was actually a rather shaky series actually seem more credible than it was.
You get frightened when you're little, and it stays with you, and it's like the scary element that I really loved.
It's just so well known, so powerful. Such an amalgam of all things. It's just utterly brilliant.
It was created using Music Concrete's very basic electronic music techniques, in that she used found sounds, things like a plucked string as a basic sound for the bass line, and basic electronic sine tones and white noise filtered and cut and shaped. It was very meticulous in that every note had to be created as a separate piece of tape, and they cut together to create the rhythm and the melodies, all on separate pieces of tape, one piece for each line. No multi-track tape recorder, so the final mix was done by playing all these pieces of tape together simultaneously off multiple tape machines and hoping they would stay in synchronisation from start to end.
if the sound we want exists already in real life, say, we can go and record it. We can get the lower sounds we need from the rhythm by slowing down the tape. And the higher sounds by speeding up the tape. And then all we have to do is cut the notes the right length. We can join them together on a loop and listen to them.
At that time, there were no synthesizers. Computers hadn't been heard of. So anything you could lay your hands on that you could record live over a microphone and get it onto tape, and then you can manipulate it once it was on tape.
The beautiful Delia Derbyshire. She always said that a very important part of her music was wine bottles in different stages of emptiness, pitching them up and pitching them down to use them as part of the sound. I don't know whether that was true, but they were always there.
She was using live recorded sounds and then treating them, and that's where she was brilliant. She could hear a sound and realise what was required to be done to it to make it interesting.
She had a lampshade, a metal lampshade. She'd hit it, you'd bang it, and it makes a sound, and then you can manipulate that with tape, speed it up, slow it down, reverse it, take the front off, make it into this fantastic thing.
Same as everybody else at the workshop and in electronic music at the time, she had to come up with techniques, had to invent techniques as she went along, purely in order to achieve an end.
I think it was Brian Hodgson from the Radiophonic Workshop talking about everyone at the Radiophonic Workshop, they got the sounds because they actually took the backs off these machines and they fiddled about in the back of the machines and they twisted and they circuit bent stuff and they did things that they weren't supposed to do, and that's how they got the brilliant sounds. It was like taking the back of the head off an object and doing a bit of like home DIY brain surgery.
Due to the awful equipment, relatively speaking, most of the stuff that we produced in the early days were, I was going to say, tormented, to say the least. There was many letters in Radio Times about, what is this fearful noise coming out to accompany these so-called arty programmes? It sounds like skeletons on a corrugated iron roof and all things like this.
But it created this aesthetic for lots of people that make music now. You know, all through the 60s and the 70s, there was this bleak, crazy music on TV shows. And, you know, it's burnt itself into our brains, I think. I think that's the legacy of it, a lot of it, for us anyway, you know.
I was told in no uncertain terms that the BBC does not employ composers. And so it was only by gradually sort of infiltrating the system that I managed to do this music. I think you'd call that music, wouldn't you?
In the early days, those working at the workshop weren't called composers, they were called assistants. Occasionally they'd be asked to create a piece of music, but most of the time it was sound design for television and radio programmes. Or you would get a composer, like with the Doctor Who theme, Ron Grainer, who would come in with a pre-composed piece which they would then realise.
And apparently Ron Grainer, he thought Delia should get a credit for it. He was happy for her to have a writing credit. But the whole ethos of the Radiophonic Workshop is that nobody got credit outside of being a workshop employee.
The BBC changed their rules later, but they wouldn't change them retrospectively. If they had, then, you know, she'd have got a lot of money from the Doctor Who thing, which she got nothing from.
I was in Coventry yesterday for the Doctor Who convention, and somebody very cleverly said to me, because they knew I was born and bred in Coventry, Coventry, born, bred and split.
Thank you.
abstract sound because you don't know the source of it. It's a young child. And then the all clear. That's electronic music in those days. After the worst blitz, I was shifted off to Preston, which is where my parents came from. Well, I remember it myself. The sound of clogs on cobbles. You know, people going to the mill at 6 o'clock in the morning or something. That must be such an influence on me. Even at school, I had this great interest in sound, the theory of sound. You know, the waves, the waves, the waves. I was quite a clever girl and was accepted to read mathematics at Cambridge, which is quite something for a working class girl in the 50s, where only 1 in 10 were female.
In the end, her degree was actually in mathematics and music, so her approach to music was very mathematical. She used to plot out her tunes on pieces of graph paper, use a slide rule, you know. I mean, other people just didn't work like that. Other people just sat at the keyboard and played it.
To do maths, you have to be obsessed. You have to get it right. And I think she was meticulous.
When she first came to the workshop, she rummaged along the bookshelves and said, oh, you've got this book. And this book had a lot of tables in about frequencies. Anyway, she went through this book and she found masses of faults, of mistakes in the tables. So she sat down and corrected all those before she started, you know.
I have heard it said that she was more mathematician than musician. And it may be true, but she had this wonderful mind which was able to imagine an end result creatively and artistically, musically, but also this analytical side to herself, the mathematical side to herself, which allowed her to analyse the path from start to finish.
This piece called Door to Door, which is all cut up from door knockings and stuff, and it's an incredibly laborious job to do it with tape. You know, every time you want a bit of silence, you know that so many inches is so many seconds of silence, and you have to splice all this in, splice it all without glitching, and it's quite painstaking work. It's very easy to do it on a computer, where if you screw it up, you just go and do it again. You don't have to re-record it, so you can cut it up again, and, you know, it's quite a discipline. Delia could make music, if you like, out of anything, whether it was sounds or people's voices, but I think she was much better at radio.
Oh, the radio was the most important thing in my life. Just listening to the radio was my education. And so I got music.
Her whole life revolved around music, really. Just talking to people about music or actually writing it or listening to it on the radio. Classical music, usually.
When I was doing the inventions with Barry Bermange, he wanted sounds which would sound like a Gothic altar piece. Oh, I said, yes, what a good idea. But what do you really mean? What sort of sounds? He said, well, give me a pencil and paper. I did. And with great care and elaboration, he drew me a beautiful Gothic altar piece and said, that's the sort of sound I want.
Thank you.
She wasn't very good at deadlines. She was an absolute perfectionist. And even if it sounded fine to everybody else, she would still want to re-record it and re-record it till she thought it was right.
And she always said she had reverse adrenaline. The nearer the deadline got, the slower she would get until there was this point almost when she would come to a standstill. When she was enthusiastic, she was enthusiastic. She would really go over the top. But just as when she was depressed, she would be really depressed and go, really sink down, hardly speak to you for days.
I disappeared under the sea. And I would surface again. Come up again. Then I would go down into the water.
Idea of her staying at the Radiophonic Workshop made available till very late at night when everyone else had buggered off home, so that she could use the corridors and the hallways to put her tape all the way round. So she was doing these massive tape loops that were like sonic maps.
She left the studio one night and she was working on a song, and she was riding along on a bicycle, and she thought, oh yeah, I've got it. So she stopped the bicycle to write everything down and suddenly realised that she didn't know where she was. She'd having crossed London, crossed the Thames, because she was so busy working on the song.
The 60s was a lovely blooming time, but something happened in the 70s which made it not right. The world went out of tune with itself. The BBC was out of tune with itself. London went wrong. The country went wrong. The world. There was something that went wrong. To me, everything was out of tune in the world. So I fled the BBC, and I thought I'd go as far north in England as I can.
I think by 1973, when Delia left the workshop, electronic music play that Delia didn't entirely understand, or in a way probably approve of, in that synthesizers were becoming more commonplace. She did work with the early EMS synthesizers, the PCS3 and the Synthia, but she didn't want to make sort of synthesized bass lines and synthesized lead lines. It wasn't organic enough for her.
I was looking forward to being able to do things much more quickly, but I think I'm still disappointed with synthesizers and what one can do with them, with the flexibility of them. I'd still like to get inside them somewhere and make it do a more human sound than what it does.
By 1973, things were changing. The pressure was mounting. Deadlines were getting shorter. And maybe some fresh clashes of personalities and all sorts of things were going on that Delia just didn't perhaps deal with, and so she felt she needed to get out and take a break. Sadly, after she left the workshop, she didn't really make any more music. She did collaborate a bit, but it never really took off.
She was writing things. She was constantly writing things down, but not actually recording them, realising them. Delia's house was a bit disorganised.
She seemed to have kept a hell of a lot of newspapers. The staircase was stacked, and her philosophy was, well, whenever my house got dirty before, I just moved.
She was a bit crazy, and she was using far too much alcohol. But, you know, she's a very creative person. I suppose you just make allowances.
But there's a fine line between insanity and genius, and I think she danced a tightrope on that line for quite a while.
It must have been about 96 or 97. We were sitting there in the studio in Coventry working on a track called Delia Derbyshire. We thought it'd be, you know, we should try and get in touch with her. So we got out the phone book and looked her up. And from that, we just started talking four, five, six nights a week, usually very late at night, discussed stuff. She loved talking about music.
The music I was doing in the 60s was either too lascivious or too sophisticated. But no, we're going back to the sexist thing. And so people would say to me, you must be an ardent feminist. But looking back, I think I was a post-feminist before feminism was invented. I'm going far too away now. Tell my whole life story. You haven't got time.
I was trying to show her, really, and she understood some of the things that she'd been trying to do and some of the things that she pioneered, which were incredibly hard to do then, were incredibly easy to do now.
Forward now, there was a huge long gap, decades of gap, but now I feel really strong and wanting to do beautiful stuff again.
Towards what became the end of her life, we started actually putting stuff together.
Everything is electronic now. It's difficult to say what is electronic music. And I suppose that everybody who works in the medium does so in a different way, and there are so many thousands of different facets.
I think at last, this century, the technology has caught up with Delia. We can now do digitally what Delia was doing in analog terms. And I think Delia would be having a ball now.
Today, the discovery of 267 tapes of work by composer Delia Derbyshire. It's been over 40 years since Delia's highly original rendering of the Doctor Who theme, and now there may be more examples of her innovation in the field of electronic music. The recordings were found in Ms. Derbyshire's attic following her death in 2001, and are only now being made public several years later. Amongst the collection, dramatically eerie theatre sound effects, hypnotising ambient soundscapes, and possibly the first ever electronic dance track, a piece which could easily be mistaken for something created today instead of back in the 1960s. An increasing number of contemporary musicians are citing her as an influence, and it's likely Delia's work will be considered groundbreaking for many years to come.
Oh, I'm glad we built up to something. That's lovely.
Delia Derbyshire on today's Digital Divide. It's your host, Rabia Yeaman. Thanks for tuning in. If you hung in there, you get a little invisible listener badge for being intrepid. And thanks so much for tuning in today. And by the way, KBOO, as you are no doubt aware, has been running a Kickstarter. And on Wednesday around 5 p.m., we reached our $20,000 goal thanks to a long time and very dedicated and active volunteer and community member who saw time running out and wanted to make sure that our make it or lose it goal, that we made it. So thank you to everyone who backed that project and helped spread the word. Your support of independent media is not going unnoticed. And I know you know how unique that KBOO is, a community radio station, a full power station that is mostly volunteer driven. It's practically unheard of when you talk to people who work or volunteer at other radio stations. They are incredulous that we have volunteers live on the air 24 hours a day. And they say, how do you do it? And I say, we can't get rid of them. It's empowering. It's fun. It's creative. And it's a vital community service that KBOO provides. We do have a stretch goal of $25,000 on that Kickstarter. It ends tomorrow. So you can still go to kickstarter.com/KBOO and donate. You can do it online. It's safe. There is a small fee that comes out for credit card processing, just like everywhere you buy online. And we don't want that to be a hindrance to you. Go ahead and make that donation today. That is going to go to training people in the community in Portland to make media, to make podcasts, to be citizen reporters. And that means you. Come on in, get some free training, and you never know, your life might change forever. Anyway, we'll see you back here on the Digital Divide next month in April on the second Friday at 11 a.m. And we look forward to meeting you back here then. Thanks for tuning in.
support our beloved KABU. Why? Because for 50 years, KABU has stood by us, helped lift us up, give us a voice, amplified our voice. KABU has been with us through thick and thin, through good times and not so good times. In short, they have been beside us as we have lived our lives. This is community radio. In truth, KABU is really us, all of us. Whether you donate $5 a year or $5,000, or just listen, KABU is a collective community fabric woven together. It is something to celebrate, to treasure. Not just this year, but every year. It is something that every community deserves to have. This is the last day we have to make our goal of $20,000. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter and thank you for your support of KABU.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Enough National School Walkout on Wednesday, March 14th, 10 a.m. at Roseway Heights School in Portland. Enough is calling for students, teachers, school administrators, parents, and allies to take part in the National School Walkout for 17 minutes to protest Congress's inaction in response to gun violence. Again, that's Enough National School Walkout on Wednesday, March 14th, 10 a.m. at Roseway Heights School, 7334 Northeast Siskiyou Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, Hood River and the Gorge at 91.9 FM, Philomath and Corvallis at 104.3 FM, and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
I hate a song that makes you think that you're not any good. I hate a song that makes you think you're just born to lose, bound to lose, no good to nobody, no good for nothing, because you're either too old or too young or too fat or too thin or too ugly or too this or too that. Songs that run you down or songs that poke fun at you on account of your bad luck or your hard traveling. I am out to fight those kind of songs to my very last breath of air and my last drop of blood. I'm out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that will make you take pride in yourself.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Don Jacobson, the program Moving On, and I feature